Hello and welcome into another edition of Seattle Nice. I'm David Hyde here with Seattle's only City Hall reporter, Erica C. Barnett of Publicola, also the editor and publisher of Publicola. Erica, how you doing?
Good. I know I'm not the only City Hall reporter because you were at City Hall the other day.
I'm no City Hall reporter. Also with us, Seattle's last remaining political consultant, Sandeep Kaushik. How are you doing?
I'm good. And it's so true. It's a dying profession. Politics is over.
All right. This week, we are talking about the big news in Seattle politics. Of course, I'm not talking about the New Hampshire primary results or the fact that Nikki Haley's staying in, at least until South Carolina. We're talking about the position 8 appointment to replace Teresa Mosqueda. The suspense has been killing us. It's finally over. We had no idea what was going to happen. Turns out Chinatown International District activist Tanya Wu got the seat, and Erica found out is running for that seat.
Yeah. I mean, like the appointment itself, this is, you know, kind of a foregone conclusion and something that was already widely known. I mean, I think that there's some fatigue. We were discussing it off mic about even talking about this appointment because it has just felt like for months it was known that the city council was going to appoint Tanya Wu. Now, that raises a question about whether there should be foregone conclusions at city council in this way. And why did they go through this whole process of encouraging people in the general public to apply for this position? 72 people submitted applications. It was narrowed down to 8. But even among those 8, I mean, they knew pretty much from the beginning that this was extremely unlikely. They were extremely unlikely to win this position and that Tanya Wu was kind of the anointed one. And so, you know, I mean, my big takeaway is that, you know, it really breeds cynicism in the political process in Seattle. And I'm talking about, you know, not among journalists and political consultants, but in the general public, when journalists can say, you know, in November, well, they're probably going to appoint Tanya Wu. And then in January, that is exactly what they do. And, you know, no amount of effort and work by people who sincerely wanted this position, applied, you know, went through the process of campaigning and sort of whipping up support, people to come out and speak on their behalf, et cetera. You know, it was all kind of, I mean, ultimately, you know, I guess I wouldn't go so far as to say a sham because they did go through the required process, but, you know, felt a little pointless if you were one of those 71 other candidates.
You got pretty close to saying it was a sham. It was a sort of a sham.
Well, I mean,
kind of sham.
They have a process and they followed it properly. And I think that, you know, the council didn't necessarily, I mean, I don't know their hearts and minds. I'm sure there are many on the council who did sincerely consider the other candidates, but ended up with this, you know, sort of inevitable Tanya Wu result. But like I said, I mean, it breeds cynicism. And the cynicism comes from the fact that we knew all along what was going to happen. The thing that we knew was going to happen. And now, as a political class, you know, I'm sure Sandeep will have something to say about how we should all just move along and get over, you know, whatever we wanted, because this council, you know, is an ideological lockstep and they have the right to appoint anyone they want, which, of course, they do. But yeah, it just feels like a real letdown from the point of view of, you know, anyone who, you know, has even watched other processes like this, you know, which typically will go into multiple ballots and, you know, there's a real debate. And that just did not happen at all this time.
Almost a sham, Sandeep Kaushik.
Almost a sham. I don't think it was a sham. I will say this. I think it was the least suspenseful appointment process in recent memory. And I do think Tanya, from the moment it began, had the inside track to get it. That said, I don't think it was a done deal from day one. I do think there were various constituency groups, including the business community, folks in the mayor's office, some of all these players that I see a lot of kind of incorrect sort of spouting off on social media that these people were all, you know, 100% aligned from day one with Tanya Wu. And that's not true. Early in the process, before, you know, the holidays, there was a lot of kind of casting about and who's out there and who might get in. And people were kind of playing their cards closer to the vest. That said, Tanya always had some momentum, right? She had a petition from the, you know, signed by lots and lots of people, more than, I don't know, kind of 1,500 people in the Asian community backing her that she put together early on. And none of the other, no really, really strong alternative emerged. And none of the candidates that did end up as finalists ever got a whole lot of momentum behind them. And so what was always kind of a, you know, advantage Tanya turned into victory Tanya, right? Because
well, I think when you're talking about people got together and they were discussing who it should be, I mean, I think that's exactly what I'm talking about. Like the fact that the parties that you're talking about, Harold's camp, you know, was divided. Business was maybe divided. But ordinary voters, like, you know, who go and cast their ballots, you know, think that they are casting a ballot for a person and their ballot matters. And when a candidate says, I will represent the community, the ordinary voter does not think that community consists of Bruce Harrell and the business community and what they decide is, you know, is going to happen. And so, I mean, I think what you're describing is exactly the thing that breeds cynicism. It's, you know, wow, there was some debate between the real players.
This came up last time. Who got more votes than Tanya Wu, who was up there?
That would be Tammy Morales.
Who was among the eight finalists who had more votes than Tanya Wu.
That's not how the appointment process works, well, David.
I mean, it's not. Exactly. I don't quite get your point about the voters. And if we are going to break the voters, got more votes than anybody else.
When I talk about the voters, I'm saying the public in Seattle, not even voters in her district. I'm not speaking about the last election. I'm speaking specifically to the fact that Sandeep was saying the backroom players hadn't quite decided on who it would be yet. And I think that, you know, this is a reason people don't vote, because they don't think their vote matters. And I think this breeds that cynicism, you know, and sort of confirms that they're right.
Well, first of all, it was a councilmanic process, right? It wasn't a vote of the people, right? It's appointment by the council. And every appointment we've had before has had exactly the same kind of jockeying. Though I think in previous appointments, who had the juice, right, was different, right? There was sort of left progressive groups in some of the previous appointments, or labor in particular. I think, but you know, in the appointment that led to Abel Pacheco when he was filling in the remainder of Kim Burgess's term after Tim left, I think labor played a significant influence in you know, kind of how that played out. But again, it's a consummated process. And I will say, in Tanya's defense, nobody else among the finalists had a petition with 1,500 signatories on it saying appoint her. Nobody else turned out as many people speaking on her behalf.
But it's a councilmanic process, not a campaign. And the people that I spoke to, including Lynn Tai and Steve Strand, you know, immediately before the vote, you know, they're both like, well, obviously this is going to go the way it's going to go. And, you know, what I heard from them was, we didn't realize that we had to treat this like, you know, like an actual election campaign. And I think that, you know, in the past, I mean, you're saying labor elevated Abel Pacheco. I don't think that that's quite how it worked. And also in the past,
it's more complicated,
you know, this has not
than that,
been but explicit. Somebody who is going to run again. So there's a political element to this. And, you know, and frankly, Sandeep, I'm surprised to hear you speak up in favor of an online petition, considering how much you've derided sort of auto, you know, robocalling and auto petition efforts in the past, that suddenly you're incredibly impressed by a candidate's ability to get online petition forms signed.
I think you seem to be saying that you think Tanya, like, was savvier politically than the rest of them. And I, you know, maybe that's true. Look, I'm just saying none of the other candidates demonstrated any real momentum, like, or put together any kind of, you know, effort. I think the only one I should take that back is labor and progressive groups did make a big, fairly noisy push at the end for Vivian Song. But Vivian, you know, was never going to get the appointment because Vivian had, you know, endorsed against many of the new council members, right? And whatever you think of Vivian's merits as a candidate or a potential council member, she had aligned herself with the side that lost and some of the candidates who lost against, you know, and so it was just seemed laughably unlikely that she was going to get that appointment.
If it was so laughably unlikely, I don't think she would have been among the handpicked eight. But I mean, in terms of her politics, but it was laughably unlikely that anyone was going to get the appointment other than Tanya Wu from the beginning. And so I think you're sort of doing like a, you know, a cart before the horse thing here, Sandeep. One reason people might not have mounted, you know, petition campaigns and all the things that you're saying they should have done is that this did feel like a foregone conclusion from, you know, if not the very beginning, from well before the actual appointment process even started.
Well, Tanya worked for it, and she should get some credit for that is what I'm saying. But I think one place where we might agree is I think it's pretty silly how polarized this fight got. Like, Vivian, who's Not exactly. I don't think Vivian's some kind of like, you know, raving ideologue lefty, right? I mean, Vivian, somebody worked at Goldman Sachs, for God's sakes, right? And is married to a developer and is somebody, I think, who on the school board where, you know, she's been seen as sort of in a very soft way, but somebody who opposed some of the more out there positions on the left. And yet over the course of this process, it became this big, like, you know, the evil right-wing business interests all are for Tanya. I will say also Tanya, when you listen to her on the campaign trail, she wasn't also some kind of like law and order, whip-cracking, jackbooted fascist, right? Like, I just think it got silly. Like,
nobody's
like,
saying like, any of these city council. You
guys both sat through the public forums and stuff, and you saw the lightning rounds. And do you support 1,400 cops? The mayor's plan to have 1,400. You know, Vivian and Tanya were in the same place on that. Yes. Do you support the mayor's policy on sweeps? They were in the same place on that. You know, I think where there was a big divide, a reasonably significant divide, was over the urbanism stuff, right? And I know, Erica, you've written about this, and I know you're frustrated about this, the tree stuff and the, you know, are we going to like lumify the entire city or not, or what's going to happen on that stuff? And I do think Vivian broke ranks with the other finalists in staking out a much stronger urbanist position than Tanya did.
She did. I mean, the things, just to digress for one second, the things that people were agreeing to in these lightning rounds, I think probably without fully understanding what they were agreeing to, because some of these questions from Kathy Moore were quite complex. Councilmember Kathy Moore, who did a great job, by the way, I thought, with that lightning round. But some of the tree questions that were really complex. But, you know, they were saying basically.
I was just thinking there's that housing questions that were really like, I tried using them in a radio spot and my editor was like, No, we can't use this. This is like, what is she even talking about?
but those tree questions essentially came down to, you know, will you designate every tree that is more than 24 inches that meets, you know, future criteria to be determined, but it's going to be around 8,000 trees as essentially heritage trees that can never be removed, kind of no matter where they are. And the way it was described was very like political, you know, oh, they're just on the edges of lots. Bullshit. You know, I mean, and so Vivian, I think, you know, of course, I'm much more sympathetic to the urbanist perspective on this. I think we can have trees and housing. But, you know, that was essentially those two questions were, you know, do you support housing or do you support using trees as a reason not to build housing? And I thought it was kind of stunning that everybody but Vivian Song said that they did.
Well, some of these questions were asked too, and maybe not exactly the tree stuff that Kathy asked, but, you know, in the context of, in a racial context about displacement, right? And they all kind of went to, I think, what you would call the kind of progressive safe space. And oh, of course, we'll stop building housing if it displaces anybody ever. You know, like, of course.
It was single family housing. She asked about single family housing in the CID and
whether that should ever be changed and allowed to build apartments or anything.
And Vivian broke ranks with everybody else.
And said we should do that. And to her credit, I think she's right on that. Like I think some of this stuff, but the way it was asked was, you know, the standards.
Do you support Black legacy homeownership? It was the question essentially that got asked several times. And it's like, who's gonna say no to that?
But right. I mean, it's hard to say no to that.
But it's a complicated question.
Yeah.
And it doesn't really lend itself well to yes, no. And it is also like sort of the buzzword of the moment is to say, I support Black legacy homeownership. But there's so much embedded in that.
Yeah.
Am I telling something out of school? I'm pretty sure Kathy Moore was the only person who did not want to fill out our yes no questionnaire. She was one of the last holdouts because she thought that yes no was didn't allow for complexity. But so
that's very funny. If so,
good for her.
But her questions were good. Like
right
they
on,
were
Kathy,
good, like you
stand
said.
Up to the enemies of the people. Stand up to the enemies of the people.
Yeah, I thought they were great questions, with the exception of the tree questions and probably that housing question because they were too complex. And the tree questions just felt like, you know, and I don't know this, but it just felt like they were reading, you know, from something written by Tree Pack or one of these, you know, special interest groups that lobbies against development. But I don't know that. It's just kind of what it felt like. Like, why are we talking about trees? We've got this massive budget hole that they've got to deal with, and they're barely talking about that.
We were talking about Abel Pacheco a minute ago as one person who filled in. I'd forgotten Kirsten Harris Talley was a temporary replacement. It was a matter of, I think, months and not months and months. That appointment was pretty short. But Erica, you were covering the council back then. There wasn't a lot of outrage about that appointment. I mean, there wasn't much discussion of it at all, although she was replacing Tim Burgess, you know, which was a pretty different type of, you know, office holder. Is that partly because, you know, it was a matter of days as opposed to months and months?
Well, and I believe, yes, it was a matter of, I can't remember how many days.
It was months and months.
It wasn't months and months.
Wait. Kirsten Harris Talley was on there for a fair amount of time. Like, it wasn't the days.
Looks like almost 2 months.
Yeah, it may have felt longer to you, Sunny, because she's progressive, but...
That may be.
But...
I was not a fan.
but to answer your question, David, you know, yeah, I think that that was part of it. I believe, I don't remember for sure, but I believe she said that she would not run for this position and, you know, indeed did not. And, you know, that has been the case with most of these appointees. So it's been, you know, maybe a little less, you know, maybe a little more contested in terms of, you know, the number of people who are seeking it and who are viable candidates, but a little less contentious because it's not about, you know, the next election in just I can't do math, 9 months.
But I mean, ultimately, like these things are political appointments and the majority got their way and it was a foregone conclusion. I mean, we spent a lot of time in this podcast and in reporting kind of covering that. But I mean, is that kind of on us? It's sort of like, to some extent, is what Sandeep seems to be saying. But it seems like what Eric is saying, Sandeep, is then why have this whole elaborate process? And I'm not quite sure, just to take this a little bit full circle, like what your answer was to that. Because if you're saying, well, it wasn't as much of a foregone conclusion
I'm rejecting
you seem pretty convinced that it was close to a foregone conclusion two episodes ago or something.
I think it was very clear, again, to repeat what I think the reality of what happened was, I think it was very clear from the outset that Tanya had the inside track. Like, she had relationships, pre-existing relationships with a number of the new council members. They had all been on the ballot together and were running their campaigns together and did, to a significant extent, like, kind of hang out together, right, and became kind of bonded and became friends. So she had – so on that personal level, I think she had an advantage. She also had really, really, really strong backing in the Chinatown International District and elements of the Asian community. And there was a strong argument the Asian community was making that they felt like their voices weren't being heard and they weren't being represented. And she became the kind of avatar or representative of that community. And so
I guess you're kind of not answering the question.
I don't think it was a done deal from the
My question is this. We were just talking about these serious questions that got asked. We watched these forums that were essentially debates, and the council members got up sort of one by one and said, you know, I took this really seriously and I picked who I thought was the best person for the job based on how they performed. And I think what Erica might be saying is, no, they didn't.
Well, maybe
that's not actually necessarily what happened, or there's some skepticism. There's some skepticism about that.
I think you were touching on something, David, that's worth noting here more directly and clearly, which is that, unlike previous processes, the council members who are making the decision, pretty much, I think, across the board agreed early on, or mostly across the board, that they didn't want a caretaker. They didn't want to appoint someone who wasn't going to run for the seat. And remember, this person's got to run for the seat not only this coming November, but then again the November of next year, right? Because it's filling out a Teresa Mosqueda's term after she left for the county council. So they agreed early on they wanted somebody that they felt would not only be good on the council as some kind of interim, but would be interested in and determined and hopefully successful at running and getting elected in November. And I do think that changed the dynamics of their decision-making process. Once they made that decision, you can argue that maybe they're reading the tea leaves wrong or understanding the politics wrong, but they felt like Tanya had experience running for office. She came really close to winning in D2, which is arguably the most progressive district in the city, and therefore running in a citywide race in a progressive, but kind of more moderately inflected kind of seat citywide, that she would be a really strong candidate. I think all of those factors kind of came into play that sort of helped boost Tanya over, again, these other finalists. None of them, Vivian was the only one who had any kind of electoral campaign experience, right? Running for the school board, you know, and everybody else.
Wait, so
sort
your
of a
example,
newbie.
You're saying that Tanya is now not a newbie because she ran an unsuccessful campaign for a district election?
I think that was the perception district. And the feeling among a lot of the council members was that she was less green and more experienced. It's all relative. But again, when you're talking about other candidates, you know, whether it's Juan, I think a lot of folks liked Juan Cotto, or they liked Neha Naraya, you know, who were finalists, or some of them like Steve Strand, right? Who we've talked about, the police captain, West Precinct captain. And like I said, you can argue with this, but I think the perception evolved that Tanya was the strongest candidate to go before the voters. That will be tested this November. I think it's going to be a hotly contested race, and we will see. We will see whether that theory turns out right. But I think that did have significant influence on kind of winning the day for Tanya. Once they decided it wasn't going to be a caretaker.
Yeah. And so therefore, all the people saying that they sat up there and they truly considered every single aspect of every candidate and which one was most qualified to hit the ground running as someone who is going to have to govern and, you know, and help, you know, craft the budget and make all these difficult decisions. You're saying, Sandeep, that was all bullshit, that actually they were just trying to figure out who would win. And that is the kind of shit that makes people cynical.
I just feel like you're doing the kind of the police chief in Casablanca walking into Rick's and being like, oh no, there's gambling going on here. What's going, you know, oh, I'm horrified. Why is there politics and why are people talking? You know,
I'm not saying that, but I mean, we did go through this long process. There were people who were very passionate on, you know, who wanted these candidates that, you know, the candidates that were not Tanya Wu. And it does feel like if I was someone who had run for this position, or if I was someone who had supported someone for this position, I would kind of feel like, well, I guess I never had a fair chance in the first place. So why did I bother?
Yeah.
Can we also, before we end, return to Erica's big scoop that we did talk about last week? Mike McGinn tweeting before the vote. First test of the new city council in appointing to the citywide seat vacated by Mosqueda. Do they jump when told to by their corporate contributors, or do they look for someone to represent the whole city? Says Mike McGinn, or asks Mike McGinn, and then he retweeted himself after the vote,
of course,
saying
he did
something like, "Oh, I guess we got our answer to that now." So
retweeted himself. Good
for
Mike.
I think, you know, so I broke the story about Tim Cease, you know, Uber lobbyist. Who's been around forever, known as the Shark, who wrote a letter, you know, sort of encouraging the big business interests that spent over $1 million, you know, getting their candidates elected. And I think that, you know, independent expenditure campaigns are what, you know, can make or break a campaign now. And so that's what happened. So C said, you know, you guys need to encourage the council to you know, be steadfast, vote for Tanya Wu, and you deserve it because you spent all this money getting these other candidates into office. I'm paraphrasing. Now, that is what happened, but I don't think that it was determinative in any way, as I've made pretty clear this whole conversation. I think this was a foregone conclusion. I think it was a dumb mistake for Tim to put that in writing. I did think it was very, you know, something between funny and disheartening that, you know, a couple of council members stood up and sort of essentially blamed the media for making people believe that corporate interests had any power in the city because we reported on this letter. And, you know, Sarah Nelson referred to it as a leaked letter, which I don't even know what that means in the context of a letter that did not involve anyone in government. So how could it be leaked? It's not a government secret. It's private individuals and, you know, somebody on the chain forwards it. There are a lot of people on that chain. So I just, you know, I was kind of sitting there going, wow, like she's seriously saying that the media were the ones that weaponized this.
Clearly it wasn't intended for your eyes. Just somebody leaked it to you. I think
it's not a leak. It's not a leak.
All right, well, somebody forwarded
it. It's an email forward. That's not, I mean, come on. Like there are like five city hall reporters anymore.
Right.
And, you know, and we've got the city council president up here denouncing us for reporting and reporting things that politicians don't want. That seemed very silly to me.
It was a good scoop on your part. I think it got way overblown. It's sort of become the the narrative of the left, and Mike McGinn's tweet is hardly like unique. There's hundreds of these. I thought for a while all the lefties had decamped from Twitter or X or whatever you want to call it, but like this Tanya Wu thing is like my Twitter feed is just like a tweet after tweet of, oh my God,
No one cares about Twitter.
anyway, but the point being, I don't think that was nearly as determinative as some people looked. And I will say the other kind of false, there's a lot of things, oh, the mayor got their candidate, right? But it's kind of worth noting here, the mayor didn't endorse Tanya Wu, either when Tanya was running, you know, last fall, or for this appointment, right? And Team Harrell was actually divided. There are people on Team Harrell that wanted Vivian Song, and there are people on Team Harrell that wanted Tanya Wu, right? So I think there's just a lot of polarizing bullshit out there about this race, a lot of it which is only dimly or tenuously rooted in reality.
Here's why I am not willing to dismiss it as bullshit. I don't think the Tim Sees letter was determinative. I don't think businesses all were like, oh yes sir, we didn't know we were supposed to support this candidate. I mean, come on. But I do think that the reason it took off and the reason where people were so angry about it is because it confirmed something that they already suspected, which is that, you know, the fix was in, I believe to use your word, Sandeep, for Tanya Wu from the very beginning. And that part of the reason why is because big businesses spent a tremendous amount of money this last campaign on independent expenditure campaigns to elect the council that we have. So I think that, you know, the grain of truth in all that is that, you know, It is very hard to run a campaign if big business is against you. And by big business, I mean, you know, this is mostly real estate businesses, you know, banking interests, people that, you know, have been funding these IE campaigns that are getting bigger and bigger in every single election. And it does kind of feel like that is what determines elections now. So that's where it was more of a confirmation than, you know, some big, you know, emerging scandal that nobody knew about.
I would sort of flip the coin on that and say the story here was not that like big business spent some crazy inordinate amount in the way that, you know, the $1 million Amazon contribution in 2019, right at the last day, 3 weeks before the election, that you're allowed to make unlimited contribution, sort of blew up in their faces. What was really striking about this last election cycle is that progressives and labor, who tended to fund in rough parity in these races, stood down to a really large extent in this last cycle. So I agree with you. There was an asymmetry of spending. I was on the losing side of this with the race in District 3, where I was working with Alex Hudson, and we got outspent 2 or 3 to 1, right, in the end and lost. So I do think there was an asymmetry of spending, but I don't think the business spending was out of line. But it's just that there was a noticeable and kind of still somewhat inexplicable disappearance of all the typical left progressive money that flows into the IEs in these races this summer.
Well, typically, I mean, if you were to add up the sides over, you know, the last, you know, let's say since honest elections passed and, you know, democracy vouchers became a thing and campaign finance limits became more of a thing, I am willing to bet that business has spent significantly more than labor on local district city council elections, to say nothing of the mayor's races. But it is true, they didn't spend big in these, you know, sort of hyper-local races this time around.
I would say the measuring point should be starting in January 2020 when Lorena Gonzalez passed the quote-unquote foreign influence corporations law, which actually sidelined businesses themselves from contributing directly to any races, including IEs, I think.
Oh, come on. I mean,
in the 2021 mayor's race, there was a total parity of spending, right? You know, on the IE side, or not entirely. I think the business side did spend a little bit more, but close. It wasn't like there was some kind of way.
Well, to be clear, the people that were putting hundreds of thousands, the interest that were putting hundreds of thousands of dollars into this election, were not Amazon. I mean, when you talk about that piece of legislation, which I know you were really, you know, upset by or offended by.
When you talk about that,
it doesn't impact the people or the companies that are putting money into these IEs, because they are, by and large, local or state companies. So
companies aren't contributing to the IEs at all. They are all banned from the IEs according to that law. It is individuals. It is what you're talking about is people are making personal contributions.
So every representative of Goodman Real Estate. So, okay. We're getting a bit down a rabbit hole, but when every individual sort of owner or representative of Goodman Real Estate gives, you know, a few hundred thousand dollars, that adds up pretty quickly. Right. And we are looking at, again, like well over $1 million. Rob Saka, for example, got $600,000 from a business-backed PAC. So big, big money going into these races this time.
Like
so
I said, in recent memory, there was similar levels of money going in on the other side. It just didn't materialize this year for reasons that I think are kind of interesting, and but probably not worth talking about here. I think it has to do with the fact that the emergence of Democratic supermajorities in Olympia has focused the focus of a lot of progressive groups and labor to trying to enact stuff at the state level now, where before they didn't feel like they could do that there. And so Seattle became the crucible or testing ground for that stuff. So I do think that's had a significant and unexpected impact in this last cycle for sure.
All right. Another edition of Seattle Nice talking about process. We're going to move beyond process next week. We've got exciting, exciting things happening for the rest of the year. Thanks to everybody for listening. Thanks to Sandeep Kashyap, Erica C. Barnett. I'm David Hyde. And our editor, Quinn Waller, you know, who you can help support by helping support this podcast by going to patreon.com/Seattle Nice, right?
Yeah. And by the way, thank you too to all the new donors. We got a bunch of new donors. We should give them a shout out.
Thanks to everybody so much for donating. And thanks everybody for listening.